First case on our calendar is 03-2035, Lee McAdoo Hess versus Norwalk Southern Railway. Mr. D'Amico.
May it please the court. Good morning, David D'Amico, on behalf of the appellant Norfolk Southern Railway Company. I was trial counsel in this case, along with Kevin Alexanderson. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. It is the position of the appellant Norfolk Southern that the 8th District erred in this case by applying state law to a substantive issue, damages, which is properly governed by federal common law. More specifically, federal common law determines the amount of a set-off to be applied to a verdict for monetary damages against a non-settling railroad defendant in an FVLA case. At the outset, I think it's important to note that the appellees have conceded on page 15 of their brief that damages under the FVLA are a substantive matter and thus governed by federal law. In making this admission, appellees implicitly agree that the 8th District has erred by applying state statutory law. If we start with the proposition that federal common law applies and move forward from there, the question becomes, what is the proper method for dealing with settlements by co-tortfeasors in an FVLA case? We believe the answer is found in the United States Supreme Court decision of McDermott versus AmClyde. That case sets forth the applicable federal common law on this issue of set-offs. McDermott, of course, was an Admiralty Maritime tort claim where the court addressed the precise issue of this case. In McDermott, at page 204, the court said, the issue is whether the liability of the non-settling defendants should be calculated with reference to the jury's allocation of proportionate responsibility or by giving the non-settling defendants a credit for the dollar amount of the settlement. In McDermott, the United States Supreme Court held that the correct approach was the proportionate share rule.
Was that just a property damage case?
It was, but the
In property damage cases, don't you have a much more fixed certain number that where you can really clearly argue a double recovery, whereas in these type of cases where you have lots of types of damages that are not recoverable, that's a much more fluid number, and it's like comparing apples to oranges, isn't it?
Well, a couple of comments, if I may. First of all, McDermott has been extended well beyond property damage cases. In fact, I believe on pages 13, 14, and 15, we discussed the number of cases where McDermott has been followed, including such things as federal securities law. Secondly, I think this court is bound by McDermott on the basis that it is a Jones Act case, and the United States Supreme Court has said in Kiernan that the law in the FVLA and the law under the Jones Act is to be applied vis-a-vis one another. So the fact that it's a property damage case, I don't think bears any on this issue at all. I think it's a red herring. And the fact that jurors are often asked to allocate fault, which they did in this case with respect to comparative negligence.
Well, counsel, would you back up and read that last statement from your Jones case that you just read to us?
You would like that reference, Your Honor?
No, what you just said before Justice Stratton asked you a question.
About the Kiernan case?
About the treatment of it. I thought what you read to us was it was a deduction. A deduction. The amount of the settlement was a deduction.
In McDermott?
In the Jones case.
No. The court rejected that approach, the pro tanto set-off approach, and said that the proper method for dealing with a settlement is for the jury to decide the proportionate shares.
That isn't what you just read us, though.
I believe that is what the McDermott language.
Well, then, why don't you explain the language of your Norfolk and Western case, which comes much later than the Jones case, 2003, in which the Supreme Court, on page says Norfolk's view also runs counter to a century of FELA jurisprudence. No FELA decision made by this court so much as hints that the statute mandates apportionment of damages among potentially liable tortfeasors.
I think that the Ayers case...
How do you explain that?
Pardon me?
How do you explain that?
The Ayers case is entirely consistent with McDermott. They deal with two different issues. The Ayers case deals with joint and several liability, a situation when there has been a judgment against more than one defendant. The McDermott case said quite clearly that there is no tension between joint and several liability and a proportionate share approach. If I may expand on that, at page 221, the McDermott court stated, after stating there's no tension between joint and several liability and the proportionate share approach, they state joint and several liability applies when there has been a judgment against multiple defendants. It can result in one defendant's paying more than its apportioned share of liability when the plaintiff's recover from other defendants is limited by factors beyond the plaintiff's control, such as defendant's insolvency. When the limitation of the plaintiff's recovery arise from outside forces, joint and several liability makes the other defendants, rather than the innocent plaintiff, responsible for the shortfall. Here's the distinction.
Did these plaintiffs work for some other railroad besides your client or your client's predecessor?
That was not an issue in this case, no.
No, I didn't ask whether it was an issue. I asked if they worked for anybody else.
They did have other employment at various times. There were four plaintiffs, of course.
Did they work for other railroads?
I do not believe so, no.
So you want a new trial when the settlement was, what, $9,000?
In total, I believe it's $30,000 for that was the settlements with the various manufacturers of asbestos-containing products.
Does it make any difference, the fact that these were not co-defendants, that they were not even part of this action?
Absolutely not. If you look at the McDermott reasoning and when they adopt the proportionate share approach, what they looked at was the restatement of torts second, section 886, and I believe comments M and B. Under the restatement section, there is no distinction between joint tortfeasors, whether they are co-joint tortfeasors, i.e., what we have in this case, where they are not a party, or joint tortfeasors in the same case. The restatement makes no distinction as to the application of the proportionate share rule and whether the co-tortfeasors are parties or not.
You keep maintaining in your briefs that the court improperly relied on Revised Code 2307 and Fiedelholz, but I couldn't find that in the Court of Appeals opinion. They based their decision on Ayers. How do you get to that conclusion from the court's decision based on Ayers?
Well, I think what we were striving to point out was the lower court's reliance on the contribution statute. And it's our position that the contribution statute is state law and has no application, similarly to the Freinholz case.
But that's not the basis of the Court of Appeals decision, is it?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals decision is clearly based on the state statutory law and the fact that we were apparently not entitled to contribution under that statute.
But it doesn't cite it at all. It only refers to heirs as the basis for its conclusion.
Well,
that's a federal decision, not a state decision.
Heirs certainly is a federal decision, and I think it, again, is misguided reliance on joint and several liability, which is not the issue that we have here. The issue here is a settlement with a co-tortfeasor.
How do we get to the point that we never learn of the settlement till post-verdict?
We got to that point by virtue of the fact that we had requested that information in discovery and were denied that information.
On what basis?
The plaintiffs refused to answer that question, and we were denied relief on that issue until post-trial. So we had no—
What efforts did you make to secure that after the refusal?
We sought that information. I'm not sure that it's part of the record, Your Honor, unfortunately, but we sought that information prior to trial.
Is there anywhere in the record we could determine that you did seek that information and there was a refusal?
I think in one of our footnotes at the very beginning of our brief, we make reference to the efforts that we did make to
but
find out.
But there's no deposition answer, there's no discovery request, there's no medical information request, there's no history of illness request of any of the plaintiffs?
It's an issue. Again, this isn't part of the record that we fought repeatedly.
No, that's what I'm asking you. Is there anywhere in the record that I could find that?
I'll have to check quickly, and perhaps I can address that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
If I can find anything.
Counsel, looking at the heirs case, I have great difficulty understanding how it just doesn't control. And answer this, that your company sought the same thing in heirs. It sought to, in fact, Justice Ginsburg discusses that you sought to have the jury apportion damages, not just between your company, but between other employers who had potentially caused asbestos exposure. We're dealing with the same exact issue here, asbestos, and the same issues were raised.
I would beg to differ again that they are two different issues. Number one, joint and several liability. Heirs did not involve a settlement. Number two.
But it involved the request at the trial court level to do exactly what you're asking us to send this case back to have done. And the Supreme Court said no.
I don't think the Supreme Court and heirs extended their decision to reverse McDermott. I think that if they had the perfect opportunity.
They didn't need to. They discussed what you're asking us to find because your company requested the trial court at the trial level to do exactly what you're saying the trial court should have done here. It's right in Justice Ginsburg's opinion.
I would beg to differ again that they are two different issues. And
Mr. D'Amico, I think the problem that Justice Pfeiffer is addressing is the paragraph in the opinion that says, as to the second issue, we declined to write new law requiring an initial apportionment of damages among potential tortfeasors. FELA's express terms, reinforced by consistent judicial application, allow a worker to recover his entire damages from a railroad whose negligence caused an injury, thus placing on the railroad the burden of seeking contribution. I think that's the point Justice Pfeiffer's trying to have you address.
I understand exactly what the point is, and it's our position that the heirs case does not reverse McDermott. It did not go that far. It did not look at the precise issue we have in this case. It did not deal with a settlement. And there is a difference between a settlement and joint and several liability. And quite frankly, that's what our position is on the heirs' decision vis-a-vis McDermott and the interplay of this case.
Counsel, where does it say that there's a distinction between what you just said, a settlement by potential tortfeasors and the parties that you are relying on in making that statement with Ayers?
I think the McDermott case specifically discusses at 221 the difference and the interplay between a settlement and joint and several liability. And it clearly makes a distinction between the two. I believe my time is
up. Thank you, Mr. D'Amico. Mr. McDermott.
Now, you didn't have anything to do with that case he cited, did you? I'm just kidding.
It doesn't always happen. May it please the court, I am Kevin McDermott. I'm here on behalf of Appalese, the Hess, the Miller, the Baxter Wyatt family, and the Charlie Miller family. I'm asking that this court affirm the 8th District Court of Appeals opinion in this case, I believe was the proper analysis. I'm asking that this court also follow the United States Supreme Court case in Ayers versus Norfolk and Western Railroad, which was decided almost a year ago.
Counsel, would you address the last topic that was brought up by opposing counsel in his contention that McDermott makes a distinction between settlement and joint tortfeasors and thereby trumps what is explicitly stated in Norfolk versus Ayers with regards to whole liability attaching to a railroad employer?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. First of all, I want to point out McDermott was not a Jones Act case. It's an Admiralty case.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Was not a Jones Act case. It is an Admiralty case. Mm-hmm. As Justice Ratton pointed out, it's a property damage case by the R.J. McDermott Company, formerly Babcock and Wilcox, against some derrick crane that fell on the Gulf of Mexico. And in that case, actually, the McDermott Company got more than the verdict. And the Supreme Court said that was okay, just as an aside. But why that case does not apply in this case are twofold. Number one, McDermott relies on a case called reliable transfer. And in a reliable transfer, there used to be an old admiralty concept called divided damages rule. And in the divided damages rule, wasn't fair in the calculation with the case in McDermott. So what the court said was we must strive for fairness. And where we can be fair, we want to put the McDermott Company in the best position possible. Because had they followed the divided damages rule, the other two co-defendants in McDermott would have only had to have paid a pittance of what they were ultimately responsible for. That's the reason. But if you read the language in a reliable transfer, it strives for fairness. Now, after reliable transfer in McDermott comes the Ayers decision. And what the railroad really seeks here is, again, apportionment. This is an FVLA case. This is not a third-party liability case. As Ayers points out, you can recover all of your damages from the railroad that are entitled. Secondly, they receive contributory negligence setoffs in these cases. You know, for 6 days, the railroad argued that all these problems were caused by these gentlemen's other conditions and smoking and everything else, and they received, two of them had a 50% contrib award, the other two had a 25% contrib award, and I will tell you that three of them quit smoking before 1968 when the warnings came out.
Let me ask you the same question I asked your opponent.
Yes.
How is it that the information about the prior recovery wasn't delivered in the course of the discovery?
The information about the prior recovery, the judge had said, we'll grapple that issue after the trial. We're not going to talk about what settlements these people had beforehand. And the judge made that decision early on. They made the application. The judge said, that'll be a matter we'll take up if and when we ever come to that issue. And that's why it was waited. That's why they waited, quite honestly, Judge. But Ayers is controlling here. Ayers came out a year ago. It specifically says there is no apportionment. Also, too, there are different damages. Under a third-party case, first of all, you're entitled to wrongful death damages. Secondly, you're entitled to another host of damages you're not entitled to under FELA, prejudgment interest. You're entitled to all kinds of funeral expenses. These things are not compensable under FELA. So what they're actually trying to do is to take another reduction after they've got contrib, and from these widows, they're trying to also lessen their responsibility when, in fact, these widows, there's no double recovery here. There has been no double recovery. What Ayers says is that they have contrib. Also, too, if you look at the section under 45 USC, it says that there is no set-off. Specifically says a United States Code. no device whatsoever to reduce the responsibility of the railroad, as in here. So not only has the Supreme Court spoken in errors, not only is the United States Code clear that there is no set-off, but I ask you that you follow a unanimous Supreme Court in errors on this issue and hold that the set-off that they asked for does not apply whatsoever.
Now, the Ayers decision seems to say that it is up to the railroad. They pay the 100%, and it's up them to seek contribution.
Correct.
How do they seek contribution?
They seek contribution by going after who they believe were potential tortfeasors that caused the injury, which is what they also said, Your Honor, in
now, if
McDermott.
Now, if those potential tortfeasors have already settled with the plaintiff, how does that affect contribution?
It doesn't. They can go after them for whatever damages they want. I will tell the court this, that the money these gentlemen received were from a bankruptcy trust. That's the money that these gentlemen received prior to this verdict. That's why it was so little, $30,000 combined for all four individuals. So they can stand in line with the trust, just as the claimants could stand in line with the trust. And many property damage and owners also are in line for that trust. Now, whether they'll ever be made whole or not, I don't know. I tend to think they probably won't. However, what Ayers says is they can get their full measure of damages.
But let's look at a broad principle, because you have some unique facts here that are
sure.
Perhaps a little more sympathetic. But what do you do in contribution? I mean, in the regular contribution statutes, if some defendant has paid their share, you really can't get contribution from them. But then you get a set-off for the amount that they've paid. Here, the statute or the Ayers case says they can go after contribution, but yet you're saying there's no set-off if that person who is also liable has paid some money. The railroad doesn't get any credit for that.
Your Honor, if I could, what the FELA statute says is that the railroad is responsible whole or in part for the entire injury. That's a different concept of third liability tort. It's federal workers' comp. These gentlemen can't file a workers' comp claim. They've got to file a FELA claim. And under FELA, they're entitled to certain benefits if they're injured as a result of the job. That's the difference between this and a third party. These aren't joint tortfeasors. It's a totally different standard for manufacturers. On the other hand, though, what does the law do for the railroad? It says, we'll give you contrib. Well, you wouldn't be allowed contrib in a strict liability case. There would be no contrib. So what I would say would be fair was to say, look, once these people have exceeded the damages awarded totally by the jury, and also taking into account there was no loss of consortium wrongful damages assessed, then and only then would the railroad be entitled to any contribution. That's what the statute tries to strive for, fairness of what goes on. It attempts, and sometimes a multi-party litigation, it's not easy. However, this is FELA. It's federal workers' comp for these gentlemen and their widows.
Go ahead, Jessica.
Yes.
The relevance, then, of the undisclosed settlement is nil.
Correct.
And is that, you feel, the basis? I mean, I'm a little... appellant is making issue of the fact that there was undisclosed information with regards to these settlements from this bankruptcy fund, and the court here says we'll address that subsequent to any award of damages, when in reality, according to Ayers and FELA, there is no impact. Is that correct?
Correct.
So it's a non-issue for us.
It's not an issue here. This is totally, Ayers controls totally in this case, because it's federal workers' comp, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
No, it's okay. Thank you.
I have a question. We find references in some of the cases to the fact that FELA was adopted to provide some consistency throughout the country for workers, for railroad workers. If we affirm, we run contrary to that purpose, do we not?
No, you don't, Your Honor. And the reason you don't run contrary to that purpose is because what Ayers tries to do is it tries to make the railroad worker whole, which was the intent of FELA when Congress established the statute in the early 1900s.
Well, but the appellant's argument is that these facts aside, we have to look at the legal issue here. Their argument is that if the parties settle with some tortfeasors, the assumption is they made themselves whole and that there's a double recovery. What's your response?
There is no double recovery, A, because they had contrib, B, there's different set of damages, and C, if the railroad, as in error said, if the railroad thinks that they paid more than their proportionate share, as they should under FELA, they can seek a contrib action. Nothing prevents them from doing that. It's in error three or four times, Your Honor.
Well, doesn't the settlement prevent them from seeking contribution?
No, Your Honor, because it's from a bankruptcy.
So they can go back?
They can go back like anyone else. They can stand in line.
But that's this case. Again, the legal issue here goes far beyond a bankruptcy settlement, does it not?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor.
You don't think so?
Because what this case is about is whether or not that the railroad can get apportionment. And AIR says they cannot get apportionment.
I thought it was a question of whether the federal act was supreme here and whether the state law whether the state courts could have their own common law remedy. Isn't that the issue?
Well,
the legal issue? I'm talking about the legal issue, not the facts, because that's what we're deciding. Is the legal issue? This decision will have a bearing on a lot of other situations, not bankruptcy trust. It's a basic fundamental legal issue, is it not?
At the beginning of this argument, Mr. D'Amico stood up and said that this is a matter of federal substantive law. So if it's a matter of federal substantive law, then the right of the state to have a set-off statute applied doesn't exist. I think that's the railroad's position. And they've already, they've said that's what we believe is true. That's why we are here.
That's essentially what I understand their position to be.
All right.
I have a chance to correct it if I'm wrong, but that's the way I understand their.
Okay. Yeah. But if you're asking me, should state law apply, what I'm saying to you is this. I think what the court should do if they want to apply state law, which I don't believe applies, is that they should look at the totality of the damages here, and they should assess any kind of set-off in relation to that. And courts do that every day.
So your position is state law does not apply?
Does not apply, Your Honor. It's a matter of federal law. But I thought Justice Moyer asked me, if state law did apply, what do I think the answer should be? And as a officer of the court, that's my feeling.
But do you think the Court of Appeals did not apply state law?
No, Your Honor. They relied on the language in Ayers. Ayers came out, so just so the court understands, Ayers came out after this trial, but before the Court of Appeals decision.
Let's take a different fact scenario, because this bankruptcy thing is a little skewed from what you normally would find. Let's say they had settled with another party, not the railroad, for $1 million. And now they go after the railroad and they get their full judgment from the railroad because they've not disclosed the prior. How does the railroad seek contribution under a scenario like that? They've settled, they've paid, they've released, and under state law, you'd have a set-off for the amount of the third-party contributions.
But under state law, Your Honor, they wouldn't be, because it's a FELA case, it's a FELA matter, they wouldn't be subject to the CATA statute in Ohio. The railroad could proceed against any of those entities and claim that they had paid too much in terms of whatever the verdict or settlement was. They're free to do that. CATA does not prevent them from doing that.
But the fact that they've settled and released does prevent them from contribution. There's two principles there that are in conflict. I'm not sure what the answer is. The AIR says they have a right to contribution, but how do they exercise that right if the other party's already paid $1 million, settled, and been released?
Well, if the other party had paid $1.7 million to release, what they did in McDermott, just they came to that, they did away with the pro tanto rule in McDermott, because it wasn't fair. What they strive for was to look at the totality of the damages and to come up with an idea of how do we apply this concept of set-off. And what the Supreme Court did is they reversed themselves in McDermott to try to let the McDermott company benefit from the verdict that they had. Because if they had done the divided damages rule, the other two tortfeasors would have more or less gotten off scot-free. And that's why they made that slight permutation. So I think you have to, I guess the answer is you have to look at what the fairness is involved. A hard and fast rule doesn't always apply. And I think that's what reliable transfer and McDermott also said, is that you have to look what you have in front of you.
But we also have to write law that applies to every case. And what we have in front of us may not be the normal scenario. You don't always have the bankruptcy trustee in there.
I understand, Your Honor. That's why I'm asking affirmance of the lower court opinion and for this court at this time to follow AIRS. I think AIRS, based upon the facts in front of this court, Ayers supplies the answer to this issue. Whether, if it is future case, you may get someone with $1 million settlement and only $400,000 like you had proposed, that may be a question for a different day. But I think we have to look at what's, you know, the Hess family, the Wyatt family, the Miller family, the Pope family. These are the facts that, you know, their fate is going to be controlled by. I'd like you to focus on those.
If we were to rule that there is a right of set-off, looking that down the road to the $1 million case and the bad law it would create for that scenario, does the judge have the power to look at the whole fact pattern, the whole damages thing, and say they were not fully compensated because of damages that FELA doesn't allow, and so the set-off does not apply because they have not reached that full compensation? Does the judge have the power to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So one scenario is we could set it back and have the judge look at the whole scenario as to whether a set-off is equitable because of the total damages.
You could do that, Your Honor, but I would ask again for affirmance of the 8th District's and the reliance on Ayers. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McDermott. Mr. D'Amico, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
A couple of quick points in response to Justice O'Donnell's question on what efforts we had made. I believe footnote 2 of our brief and our post-judgment briefing sets forth those efforts. The public policy considerations here are paramount. The plaintiffs have forum shopped. They have filed actions in different
jurisdictions. Counsel, that's not in this case. You've tried to argue it, but it's not in this case.
I think that the court has to look at the fact that they did split their causes of action and have sought a double recovery in this case. And if the lower court decision is permitted to stand, they will obtain a double recovery, and we are prohibited from seeking contribution from those defendants, as Ayers suggests.
Are you familiar with Shadle?
The
Shadle case?
Shadle?
Are you familiar with that case?
I am very familiar with that case.
How does that relate to the issue here?
The Shadle court got it half right, if I may
suggest.
The Shadle court got it half right, if I may suggest that.
That means half wrong.
Half wrong. They got the fact that federal law applies, but they did not understand the distinction that I have harped upon between McDermott and Ayers, the joint and several liability issue when there's been a judgment versus a settlement between co-tortfeasors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. D'Amico. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.